Tonight's speaker is a home group member, so it's kind of special. Shelly from Feet First.
You're going to lower it for us, midgets? Thank you. Okay, that's good. Hi, everybody. I'm Shelly. I'm an alcoholic. If you could bear with me for a minute, I'd like to take a moment of silence here just to kind of collect and meditate and feel more connected to you guys. You're still here. Okay. My home group is Feet First right here. It's been for many years, probably about 4 years. And I love this group and everything that we do and the connection that we all have, and that so many people show up here every Monday night to hear the messages that all the people bring. But you don't often hear us from the home group, so it's kind of nice the few times some of us have spoken. So I was asked, and I decided to pitch in when our speaker couldn't make it. So I'm nervous, and hopefully I will relax a little bit. My sobriety date is, Eric's not here, March 16th, 2001. And I've been continually free from alcohol and drugs for 11 years, and which is amazing. I have a sponsor who I adore and trust and have faith in that I use a lot. And I get a whole lot from my sponsees. Working with other people has been what's built on the foundation that I made when I walked through the steps with my sponsor. I was out there drinking and drugging for 23 years, from the time I was 15 until about 38. And I did a lot of stuff, and I put myself in a lot of compromising positions. Two marriages, three children, really bad car accident when I was 16, a mother's death, and you know, I just never, ever considered. I was completely delusional. I wasn't even in denial. I was completely delusional that I had a problem for all that time until the end. Everybody I hung out with drank and drugged the same way I did, and so I just thought it was normal, and I couldn't understand why you wouldn't drink, at least. I just never considered it an issue or a problem until the way end. You know, I grew up, my mother was alcoholic, nobody ever really realized that or talked about it. She just drank a lot, and she was crazy. I just used to think she was crazy, but come to recognize that, you know, once I learned what alcoholism was and what it was about, I realized that I'm pretty sure my mother was one of us, never chose to change that. So at my house growing up, I have one brother, and at my house growing up, we walked on eggshells all the time. We never knew when Mom was going to flip or go crazy, because she would break, slam, smash, yell, scream, hit, do whatever it took to get out her anger, anxiety, hangover, whatever, waiting for a drink. That restless, irritable, and discontent she lived in, like, all the time. And we were, like, middle-class community kind of thing, and so everything that stayed at home, everything that happened at home stayed at home. You couldn't talk about it to nobody, and so alcohol and drugs just were, I mean, if I could have started, you know, when I was three, it probably would have worked, because, you know, since understanding what alcoholism is about, I absolutely believe that alcohol was my solution for all those years. Had I not had the alcohol, I would have killed myself or done something else. But I lived my life always waiting and looking forward to when I could get drunk again. You know, it was always just my answer to everything. Like, you know, wow, I can drink later, I can drink tonight, you know, as soon as I can drink, it'll all be better. And knowing every morning I wake up in the same thing, it was the same thing every day. I had a really bad car accident when I was 16, and I was laid up for a couple months at home, broke my pelvis and my collarbone, I was in a blackout. And I can remember, like, the day or two after the accident in the hospital, I thought to myself, man, I could have died, because I thought my girlfriend was dead. And somehow that gave me a whole new lease on life. I thought, man, I could have died, man. I'm going to live, like, there's no tomorrow. I'm going to do anything I want now. You know, I got a whole new lease on life. I'm just going to party till I can't take it. And so that's what I did. And then went to college somehow, got through it without dying or killing anybody else. And my mother died the year I graduated. 1986 was not a good year for me. I graduated in December of 85. I came home and my mother was diagnosed with lung cancer, and I had to watch her for 5 months while my father would go to work during the day and just watch her die, you know, as the cancer went to her brain and whatnot. And that sucked. That really, really sucked. You know, I look back on that and it seemed like a week, and it was 5 months, and I can just remember the torture of it. And again, that was another lease on drinking for me. Go back out. My mom died. I'm 22 years old. You know, poor me. And what happened then was my mother died, and like the next day after the funeral, my father is on the telephone, and I walk into the room, and he just hangs up. He doesn't say goodbye. He doesn't do anything. I'm like, what the hell? And so I kept catching him on the phone, like, not on purpose, walk in the room, he's on the phone. I'm like, so it turns out he had this other woman. And so within 5 months, he was married. And soon after my mom died and this all started happening, this woman kept coming into my house. I didn't know her from Adam. And she's packing up everything. My mom's china. She's packing up everything in my house. I don't even talk to the lady. And I don't want to talk to her. I don't want to see her. My mom's dead, and this woman is now with my father. And so we move out of the house I grew up in, which was devastating for me. And a couple months after my mom died, I got pregnant. So I got married in November. My father got married in December. He took off, and they got a house. She had 5 kids still in school. My brother and I had already graduated from college. So he was busy with her and her 5 kids. And I hated her for jumping in and doing all this. I hated her with a passion from the moment I even knew she existed. And I fueled the fire just continuing that she did all these things, took all my mother's things, and I'd go to the house and she'd have my mom's things and her things, and I couldn't stay. I hated going there. I hated it. I would go up in the room and cry. I couldn't stand it. And because it was all about me. It was still all about me. Poor me, you know. Not that my dad's happy now. He found another woman that's going to take care of him. Nothing. I don't give a crap about that. All I care about is me, and that this woman has now really taken my father from me. My mother died, and now my father, all his attention goes on her and her kids, and I'm left with no parents. So, you know, poor me, and I drank and drugged for many more years because of it, or not because of it. It was an excuse. So I'm on my second marriage, and I have 2 more children. I have 3 kids. The marriage doesn't go too bad. We both drink and drug together a lot. And then, like, the last year, I can't take it. I get up every morning. I cry. I got to get through the day. Oh, my God, I can't get through another day. And I used to think that I had to wait till 5 o'clock to drink, but I've told my story numerous times, those of you that have sat through it. I get up in the morning, I put Bailey's in my coffee, but my delusional mind was I was just flavoring my coffee, and then I'd grab a Xanax or two that the doc prescribed, and then I'd run downstairs and do a shot behind the bar, go in the front cellar, do a bong hit, and then come back up. And my delusional mind is still saying I got to wait till 5 o'clock to drink. So if you would ask me, I swear to God, and this is not denial, this is delusion. I have no clue that I'm not touching alcohol or drugs till 5. I really believe, oh, God, 5 o'clock I can drink. When I start cooking dinner, I can drink. You know, I'll crack open the beer, and that'll be my first, you know. So, and then I'd stay up drinking and drugging for hours and doing all kinds of incomprehensible, demoralizing things. And again, wake up in the morning and say, oh, my God, I can't believe it. I got to get through another day. I hated the mornings. And I would cry. And at night, like 3 or 4 in the morning, I'd look in the mirror in the bathroom downstairs. And I'd like look in these eyes, and there was nothing. I was dead. They were vacant. There was nothing. And I would look at myself and say, what am I doing? What is going on? I've lost everything. I'm gone. There's nothing here. I have nothing. Mind you, I have 3 beautiful children, a husband that adores me, and a fine marriage at the time, and a job, and house, and car, and dog, and all that stuff. But you've heard it a million times. It didn't matter at all because everything on the inside was gone. I was blank, and I lived only for alcohol because I thought that, I don't know, it was like my lifeline. You know, it was what I needed to survive. And I started seeing this counselor, and she had said to me, I saw her for a while, like a year or two, and she had said to me one time, oh, the more we work on your mother, the more you seem to get, you know, go out partying all weekend, and I'm really concerned. I think you need to get clean and sober before we can continue. And I looked at her like she had 3 heads, and I'm like, what are you talking about? Why would I do that? And she said, and I thought to myself, okay, I get maybe the drugs, they're illegal and all, but why would I ever, ever in a million years not drink? I mean, that would just never happen. It would never happen. I would never live without alcohol. That's hideous and ridiculous, and it'll never happen. And so I said to her, well, you know, see you later. I left, and I thought, F you, lady, there's a million therapists. I'll go see somebody else who gives a crap. But that was the first time ever anybody even brought to the attention of my mind for me to even think, really? Like, it could be a problem? And so it took like a month or two that I kept looking in that mirror at 3 a.m. and looking at myself and saying, God, I got nothing. I hate life. I hate getting up in the morning, knowing full well that I've got everything around me that will keep me perfectly happy, but nothing matters. And I ended up going to my doc and telling her I had an issue, and I went away to treatment for the first time, and that was in 2000. I was shocked. I was thrilled, actually. I went up to the Karen Foundation, and I'm an alcoholic. This is awesome. That's what's wrong with me. I'm an alcoholic. I thought I was crazy. I thought there was all kinds of crap from my mom's craziness, you know. And I'm an alcoholic, and I hear about this alcoholism and drug addiction. I learn all about it, and I'm like, I'm loving this. I'm like, I'm thrilled. Okay, I got this. So I come home, and for 6 months, I, like, go to meetings late, leave early. I don't really connect. I take forever to find a sponsor. And so it doesn't really work. Within 6 months, I decide that I heard that this thing about going out and trying to control your drinking. And I never did any of that stuff because I never thought I had a problem. So I thought, you know what? Maybe I bought into this too quick and I'm not really an alcoholic. I'll go out and try that research and development thing. And so, you know, I went out like in December. And within 3 months, I was back down. I was further than I was before. Up in Vermont, oh, God, 3 feet of fresh powder, and all I want to do is get down the run so that I can drink and drug and go back up to do another run. I'd get to the top of the hill, and I'd be like, man, I got to go down till I can get to the bar, till I can get to the car, till I can get to the bathroom and get what I need. And I wanted to do that more than I wanted to hit the 3 feet of fresh powder. And that was really discouraging to me. I thought, oh, my God, the thing I love most. And now all I want to do, I love something more, which is alcohol. And so I came home with my tail between my legs, went to another rehab. And when I came out, I started in Allentown at the Mediator. And I spilled my guts the first night out and, you know, said that I can't do this. I tried, and, you know, I said, and I still remember it, you know, I heard that you'll love me until I learn to love myself. So there you go. I don't care if you don't like me, but you're just going to have to love me until I can love myself. So I got a sponsor and a commitment that night, and I started my road to recovery in March of 2001. And I've always been a social butterfly, right? So I go from bars and my basement and people's houses to the rooms of AA. And at that time, I was more involved, and it seemed up there. I don't know about, not so much now. There was more dances and this and that and the other thing. So I'm doing all this. I'm, you know, going to the diner. I'm going to meetings. I'm chairing. I'm doing this. I'm secretary. I'm doing all this stuff that I'm supposed to do. I have a sponsor. I call her, and I whine, moan, and complain, and she tries to help me solve my problems, and that was it. And I did that for 9 years, really. For about 7 years, I did that. I didn't drink and drug, but things didn't change for me. I didn't change, like, hardly at all. I still had the same selfish, self-centered behaviors. It was all about me and what I wanted and what I needed. And I came first before you, and I pretended and thought that you mattered, but you really didn't, because I still needed to get what I wanted, and I had to manipulate people to try and get what I wanted, including my husband, my children, people at work, whatever. I still ran on self-will. I just did, and then I was still pretty much the same person. With my sponsor, I had begged and pleaded, and finally at about 2.5 years, we did a 4-step, some worksheets, and we sat down, and she told me that I had control issues, and God love her, I still love her today. I guess I still kind of call her my sponsor, but I don't talk to her much, but anyway, and I made a list at some point, but I never really made amends. Now, the stepmother that I'm talking about, she's still around, and I'm sober. And now I decide one day when I'm down visiting my father and her in Virginia that I'm going to apologize to her and try and have a better relationship now that I'm sober. I was a couple years sober, so I did this self-directed amends, which I don't recommend, because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I didn't know what I was saying, and it wasn't really an amends. It was just, you know, I'm going to try and think you're better. I'm going to try and like you a little more. I didn't say those things, but that's what I was saying. It's like, you know, you kind of suck, but I'm still going to try to get along with you. So God love her. Her name's Jessie. And I did try. I tried to put aside my anger and hatred and resentment for her, but I just simmered it, really. And then my dad got sick, and I went down there. Long story short, I was in her house. My boyfriend came by. She kicked me out of the house. 11 o'clock at night, she said, "You got to leave." And I was like, "Are you freaking kidding me, lady? My dad's in ICU. They induced a coma. I can't leave. Get out of my house. Get out of my house." She didn't want me there. And I was like, "This isn't even your house. I don't care. Get out of my house." And when we left, my boyfriend says, "I hope he dies, because if he lives, this is going to kill him." Well, that didn't go over real well. So after that, he did die a couple days later, and she didn't call me that he was downgraded. And I drove down there as fast as I could with a girlfriend when I found out he was downgraded, and I got there. He had already died 2 hours prior to when I had gotten there. So remember that little resentment that was simmering? Now it's really big, because I wasn't there. She didn't call me and tell me that he was downgraded, so I wasn't able to get down there in time and see him before he died. So I got there, and he was dead for 2 hours. So that little resentment that I tried to squelch is now huge, and I'm sober. I'm sober 4.5 years at this time. Still pretty much running around with untreated alcoholism. And why does this keep changing? What time is it? Oh, it's the date. Oh, okay. So, got it. Thank you. So, where was I? Taking a sip of water. So I'm pretty pissed. I'm not going to her funeral. She's going to have a funeral for him. This is really sad. I put an obituary in the paper. I knew she was going to, but I put one in because I was having a memorial for him. Nothing to do with hers. And I didn't even mention her name in the paper. And I had my own memorial. And she had her own funeral a couple days later, which I didn't care to go to. And my father's brother, my uncle, and he wasn't happy about what my boyfriend said, and we had some words, and so we kind of, my father's brother and his wife, we kind of, you know, didn't get along so well for a little bit. We didn't talk much. So I'm sober. My dad dies. I don't do so hot with it. I ended up actually putting myself in the psych unit because I didn't really want to drink, but I didn't really want to live, and that God-sized hole was already so big, and now that my dad died, it just was, there was nothing, because he was the next closest thing to God to me, my father. So I didn't do so good. So I slowly just got through that and got through my life. Left my husband. So now I'm single. And I'm coming here. I start coming here. Because someone brought me down once. And like I said, this is probably 4 years ago. And I loved it. Like, I used to go to Akron a lot, like every year for Founders Day. And I would talk to people up there because they talk about doing the steps. Like, when you get sober, do the steps and don't wait forever. And I'm like, I had to beg my sponsor to do steps in 2.5 years. And I thought, boy, that sounds really cool. You know, I'd hear about how the old timers did it in the old days, you know, back in Akron and la, la, la. I'm like, dang, nobody seems to be doing that, you know, where I am. And, of course, I'm sure they are, but nobody that I heard or knew or I didn't pay attention or wasn't there. It wasn't presented and I didn't hear it. To me, it may have been and I missed it. Apparently, I wasn't ready. So I come and I hear these speakers down here, and I'm like, God, that sounds awesome. I would love to do the steps like that, right? So I'm coming here. This is how stubborn we are. So I'm coming here for a year, and I'm coming to the meetings, and I'm going to the diner and getting to know the home group members because I'm thinking, you know, this is awesome. I want some of this, but I haven't done what any of these people have done, none of the speakers or the home group members. But I'm still coming around and kind of like thinking by osmosis, you know, because what am I going to say, you know? Oh, by the way, excuse me, I've been coming around for a while here, but I haven't really done these steps, certainly not as outlined in the book. So I kind of let it go for 2 years. What happened was, because I was coming here, some other people were under the assumption that I knew what the hell I was doing, these other women, and they asked me to sponsor them, and I started sponsoring. Now, up until then, that was at 9 years. Probably about 8 years. Up until then, I'd only sponsored one woman for a few weeks, and that was it. That's it. I'm in here for 8 years not sponsoring anybody. So I start sponsoring these women. I have like 4 women. God has a bigger plan, I'm telling you that for sure. So I'm trying to walk through the book with these women, which I've never done, but I figure it's not that hard. I've heard, you know, it's all outlined, just follow, do what the book says, pray when they say pray, do it. So whatever. So I start trying to take them through the book the way I have no idea how to do. So, and none of them are here. Go figure. One just went away to long-term rehab in Florida, but anyway. And I'm doing all this by myself because my sponsor at this time never did the steps. She may have done some of them. I'm not sure what her history is, but hadn't done them with me. And so I couldn't really talk to her about it because she doesn't have experience really with the steps or the big book. So I'm really screwing this up. These poor women, God love them. But I'm trying. I'm trying to run their life. You know, I'm trying to give them solutions and answers when they call me. I don't know shit. I don't know nothing. And I'm giving them advice on how to run their life. And I've been running my own life all this time. I thought I was connected with this God thing, but now I know that it was just this tiny little thing and that I was missing the huge, huge picture. And I didn't know that because all you know is what you know. And I thought I had some connection with this God thing. And I did, but it was like a Shelley-designed God. And so I went away, this retreat that I started a couple years ago up in Vermont, because my husband was going to one and I wanted to go because I had never been to the Wilson House. So I just took a couple women and we did a retreat. So was it the first or the second year? Anyways, at the retreat, my one sponsee who's a little, and she was a little like that weekend, and I came home banging my head against the wall, and I blocked her number from my phone again because she gets so crazy, and that's my only recourse. And I come home, and my husband's in the shower, and I'm on my hands and knees next to the bed, and I'm like, God, I don't know what the hell. I just don't get it. I'm trying to help these women, and they aren't listening to me. I'm trying to help these women, and they're not doing what I want. And I just don't get it, God. And I wasn't asking for a sponsor. And in my mind came my sponsor, Jeff. And I was like, Jeff, why am I thinking about Jeff? Come on, God, I'm praying here. I really need some help. I don't know what the hell to do. And I think about Jeff again. And I'm like, what the hell? Why am I thinking about Jeff? And by the third time, I was like, oh, I get it. I should ask Jeff to work with me because I'd been coming around here and I had gotten to know the home group members and watched and listened, and this was not my choice. It was nothing that I dreamt up. It came and I wasn't even willing to accept what the heck I was hearing. So I told my husband, I said, I got to ask Jeff to work with me. And I had to wait. He was up in Maine and I had to wait till he came back. But I was just looking through when I was praying before coming out here. I was looking through my calendar and it was July 21st, I think, that I asked him. And then by August 17th, we were doing my fifth step. We had met once, maybe twice, and he had given me directions. And I wrote the three inventories and all the columns. And we met at the truck stop in Bloomsbury. I drove up from the shore. I was vacationing by myself, camping at the shore, and we sat there and did my fifth step. And, you know, I had said to him, especially before we sat, because we sat, the first time I sat with him, he told me some of the history, and I've been coming around for how long, so I know all this shit, so I'm like, okay. I said to myself, I've got to get everything out of my head that I think I know, that set-aside prayer. Anything I think I know or I've learned, I got to get rid of all that old shit and be ready for some whole new experience. Because, you know, I've been coming around 9 years. I mean, you know, and I heard these people from the podium and I thought, yeah, okay, but I've been coming 9 years. Ain't nothing going to happen like that to me. So we do the fourth and fifth. And when we get to my father, I had said, boy, you know, I love my dad so much. No matter what he's done, I don't care. I love him unconditionally. I said, and you know, and I said this, and it didn't seem to me much at the time, but I said, boy, I wish I could feel that way about everybody, like that unconditional love I feel for my dad. I wish I could feel that about everybody. And that was it. I just kind of said it. And then we went to Jessie, my stepmom, and, you know, I said all the things that she did. She did this, and she did that, and she didn't call me, and she kicked me out, and da, da, da. And of course, I hadn't talked to her. This is 5 years now. I hadn't talked to her. If she was going to be anywhere near where I was, like the one time in the hospital, she was coming to see my uncle, and she was coming up the elevator, I flew out the back door. I was not seeing that woman. So we get to her, and you know, we flipped the page, and we started talking about the things that I had done and how I had been, and I really, for the first time, considered. And my sponsor says to me, I said, you know, about the boyfriend in the room and everything, and he says to me, well, so you're loving up with your boyfriend in the living room. She has to keep walking by, and her husband's dying. The man she loves and adores and is the center of her world is dying, and you're right in front of her, you know, flaunting that. Don't you think that's a little inconsiderate? I was like, inconsiderate? I never thought that I would ever be inconsiderate to her, because, of course, it's all her and not me. And so, again, there was that little seed like, huh, so this is all about me, isn't it? So, all right, so then that happened. So then we go on. I do six and seven. And, you know, the seventh step is something that I always have to go back to, because that's what I need to do. Whenever anything happens and I need to do 10-step work, I got to go back and say, God, you got to remove this because I can't do it. And I have seen, when I finish telling you what's happened in my life, I have seen God do for me things I cannot do for myself. And so that 7-step deal that God has to remove it is the key, because I cannot remove it. I tried. I've thought about it. I've contemplated. I've done essays on it, and I can't do shit. And so we make a list and we go through about who and when and where and what and how for my ninth step. And I go out and make my first amends. And God saw fit to wait until I was, 7 years sober to allow me to ride a motorcycle, because I'd never thought about it prior to that. Apparently I wasn't ready or fit or safe. And so finally at 7 years sober, it came in and I started riding. So I've been riding a motorcycle and I love it. And so I ride my motorcycle out to my aunt and uncles. They're going to be my first, my father's brother. And I get out there and they're happy to see me. We chit-chat. And I call my sponsor on the way out. I stop at the gas station. I call and I say, oh, I'm on my way, blah, blah, blah. You know, pray, blah, blah, blah. So I do all that. And I get there, we talk, and I make the amends. And I didn't know. I had no clue that making amends wasn't just about me. You know, I've read and I've heard and I've been to workshops, you know, the clean up my side of the street kind of crap. And, you know, it's water under the bridge, blah, 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 all that. But I had no clue until I made that first amends. And I sat there and I made the amends. And my uncle, sitting in the back, because my aunt's, you know, the center, he's back there kind of just watching and chilling. And because he was the one who was more hurt than my aunt. So I make the amends, you know, that I know I've done things that have harmed you, and that's not the person I want to be, and that's not the person that God wants me to be. And I want to go forward and have an amended relationship and not behave in this manner anymore. And my uncle in the back starts talking. And he said, oh, Michelle, you know that it wasn't you. It was, and he went on for 10 minutes about, like, he had been burdened for 5 years about how he felt bad about what he had said and that I didn't come to the funeral. And for 10 minutes, he went on how bad he felt. And I just sat there like, I just didn't consider, I guess, that it gave him a chance to let go that which he had held on to all that time. And not that he was apologizing to me per se, but just that he was like unburdening it and letting it go, like he hadn't been able to approach me with it. And it was beautiful. I mean, it was just beautiful. I couldn't believe it. I just didn't know that I was going to free him too. So I leave there. I stop and call my sponsor and I say, oh my God, it was so awesome. I feel like Dr. Bob. I want to go out and make all my events tonight. And So I ride home, and now when I was out there, my aunt had said to me, so how many people are on this list, you know, my amends list? I said, I don't know, like 20 people. And she says, well, Jessie's not on that list, is she? And I said, well, yeah, she is. Oh, you don't have to make amends to her, she says. She did more to you than you ever did to her. See, now I love that. And you, a lot of people around here, friends and family and AA members, have cheered me on with my resentment against her. You know, yeah, you know, I, that's, you know, she did screw you, you know. This is the first time. And she says it to me. And I don't know what came over me, because my thinking before that would have been, you're right, you're right. I'm glad somebody else is on my side. I am not making amends to that bitch. Sorry. So, delete that, Eric. So, but instead, what came out of my mouth was, well, Ann, I mean, Jessie was always really nice to me and really good to me. She loved my father. She never did anything negative to my father. She never, all the nastiness I gave to her, she never gave any of it back to me. She was a real religious woman, and she just absolutely believed that God would display what needs to be done, and she just kept the faith that I would get over it one day. I don't know how she did it, because I was a bitch to her. But she never retaliated. No matter what I said or did, she never retaliated. She ironed my father's underwear. I mean, she treated him like a god. And it's true. It's absolutely true, and I know that today. And so, you know, I said that to my Aunt Ann. And I said, you know, she was always really good, and I you know, I do owe her an amends. And again, I that was not me. I would have never, if I had a moment to think about it and plan it, I'd have said the other thing, that, yeah, that's it, someone else on my side. So that came out of my mouth, and I left, and she gave me Jessie's number. So by the time I get home, it was a 20-minute ride from the Hess gas station to my house. By the time I get home, I want to call Jesse. I want to talk to Jesse. I want to see Jesse. I miss her. I feel like I love her. I feel like I want to connect with her right now. Now, we're talking, you understand, if I'd have told you how I felt on the way out to my aunt and uncle's, I'd have told you that, B-I-T-C-H, you know, I'll make amends to her when she's in her coffin, you know, da-da-da-da-da. But within 20 minutes, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, a complete 180-degree turn. I could have never, you know, people say, you hear that, you know, imagine the farthest scenario that you would or would never do. I could never even imagine that. That would change from anger and hatred to love. And that was it. Black, dark, anger, hatred in my heart turned to love. Just like that. Just like that. I didn't pray about it. I thought I'd be on my knees for years saying, God, please give me the willingness to make amends to this woman. And nothing. I did nothing. I never even got to that point. So I called Jeff, and he says, well, go ahead, call her. So I call her, and she answers. And I was glad she answered. And I was like, Jesse, it's Michelle. She paused, and I said, Burroughs. And she said, Shelly, hi, how you doing? Like, it was yesterday. Like, she loved me and missed me, and there was nothing wrong. And we talked, and we tried to set up a time to meet. So we did. Within a month, it took some time because she lives out near Harrisburg till we were whatever and can connect. And I didn't want to go to her house because I didn't want to see her house because she got all this money. You know, that was part of the resentment. My father had a fairly large inheritance, and it all went to her. He didn't make any provisions for us kids, so it all went to her, so I would never see it. So I knew she had sold his house and bought a new house. I didn't want to go to her house because she bought that house with my dad's money. So I called my sponsor, like, she keeps saying meet at her house. I don't want to go to her house. And he said, why not? I'm like, she bought that with my dad's money, blah, 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 blah. And he says, well, Shelly, it's not her house. It's God's house. She's just borrowing it. I was like, huh, that's a good point. And just like that, it was gone. And I think a lot of what's happened doing my work with Jeff is that I was just so willing and open and ready to have a new experience because I was sick and tired of feeling still so bonded to self, you know, in the third step prayer. Relieve me of the bondage of self. And I had felt bonded to self for so long because I wanted and needed certain things, and if I didn't get them, I would have to manipulate and fix, organize, manipulate, and control so it would happen my way. So I think I just was willing and ready, even after being sober for 9 years, to just have something new. So I met with her, I can't tell you. As soon as I saw her, I was so happy to see her. I mean, I hugged her, I cried, she cried. We went down and talked for a while, I made the approach and made the amends, and it, like it says in the big book, years of feuding fall away in an hour. And it was gone before I even got there. You know, she also turned around and made amends to me and said, I know I've done things that have hurt you, and that's not at all what I wanted to do. And that was it. And it is completely amended. I don't care about money. I don't care about houses. I don't care about anything. I absolutely love her. She came to my wedding here a little over a year ago, right here. And I call her. We keep in touch. She's moving back to the area, so I get to see her more. My kids get to know her better. And this is nothing ever, ever, ever. You know, I mean, you know, you hear this stuff and you read it in the book and you hear stories about this happening. And I just never thought anything like this would happen to me. I just thought I've been coming around for so long that none of this is going to happen to me. I feel like I did nothing, and I say that. I feel like I did nothing for any of these great, wonderful things to happen. But people remind me I did. I was open. I was willing. I walked through the steps, you know, and followed the directions that were outlined. You know, as far as, and I'm still making amends. In fact, I thought of another one. You know, working with other people, it brings up some amends that you forget about. You know, as far as 10, 11, and 12 go, when I am disturbed, as I am, I'll call my sponsor or I'll call somebody else. Sometimes I call different people if it has to do with my daughter, especially because that child thing, I need to speak with other people who also have children that are, because my daughters,
running around with untreated alcoholism, let's say. So, anyways, when I get disturbed, I call someone because I got to talk it out. I got to pray and say, God, remove whatever it is. Sometimes I know, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I'm just disturbed and I got to say, whatever the heck is going on, God, you got to remove it. I can't even pinpoint it, but please take it away because I know I cannot. And then I follow the rest of the outline. I call somebody. I try and go out and help somebody. And as far as 11 and 12, I learned to meditate years ago. I never did a good job, but slowly, slowly, slowly. I mean, sometimes my meditation is just reading my morning dailies and contemplating, or reading just one and contemplating it, which is what they used to consider meditation years ago, as far as the big book goes. So, but I also do sit in meditation. I can do that for a long time now, which took me forever to cultivate, because I couldn't sit still for nothing and make my mind blank. But I have practiced it, and I can tell you I love it, and I can do it easy today. Of course, I always slouch on prayer and meditation, like every single one of us. Raise your hand if you don't. No, I'm kidding. So, but I'm always trying to enlarge it. And as far as step 12 goes, that's the thing that I am so dead serious about. When I start working with other people, I sponsored a few women. I have a lot of them come and go. 1, 2, 3, send them out writing. You never hear from them again. It happens all the time. But I do have some women that have stuck and stayed, some particular sweethearts that just enlarge my life amazingly. But, you know, I think that a lot of people miss out on a couple parts when it goes through the steps. Like, you know, oh, I did a fourth and fifth. Great. No, that ain't great. Not until you followed up with more. God didn't do for me what I couldn't do for myself until I started making my amends. So for me, I'm pushing. Get to those amends. I mean, it says in the book, before we are halfway through, that means before we are halfway through our amends, which is before we're, so 0 to 50%, you can make one amends like me, and the promises start happening. So until you start your amends, until I started my amends, I wasn't opened up to that. You may be after a fourth and fifth, but I think it's kind of just, okay, yeah, now I know who I am and what I've done, and I kind of got a handle on it. But, you know, I really think the freedom comes when you start making the amends and people stop. They think fourth and fifth, that's great, I'm awesome, I'm good. I mean, that's what I did before. And it's the follow-through. You got to do 8 and 9, and then if you don't get your butt moving on calling other people when you're disturbed, you're never going to change who you are. I can't change me. I can't change me. Period, end of story. Cannot change me. Don't know how. Could write an essay. Could do a thesis on it. I still cannot change me. I mean, I'm almost 50 years old, and until God did things for me I couldn't do for myself, I couldn't change myself for crap. Even for years of therapy and medications and all kinds of crap. I can't do it. You know, this whole God deal is the deal, the only deal. You know, the whole book is all about, you know, having a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And so it's all about getting my spiritual awakening, whatever that is. And then going out and helping others. People get it and then they don't give it. And for me, I believe that, you know, 1 through 9 is the cement. So, like, you know, everybody's all, oh, microwave steps, blah, 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 blah. I can't do it. I'm all in a fog yet. I can't do it right away. Yeah, you can. They always did, and you still can today. Just do them, and then go out and start helping others. Because when I sit down with another alcoholic, and you sit down with another alcoholic, and you see a mirror, and you're doing a fourth and fifth, and right there is you in the mirror, that's when I learn. I see me. I'm like, oh, shit. That is me, and oh my, and I still do that, and I still have those things, and so that foundation of 1 through 9 that I've done now is something to build on when I sit with other alcoholics. So you're missing out on like 90% of the program if you don't go out and help others. If you don't, not help them by moving or help them by giving them a ride, I mean walking them through the steps. Open the book and sit the book and walk through the steps and get through the deal. I don't mean just, you know, being nice and friendly and doing commitments and chairing meetings. I mean freaking sitting down and doing the steps, because it is a 12-step program, and that's what we're here to do, even though, you know, it tends to be, you know, well, just I went to a bunch of meetings. Okay, good. how is that? I mean, you know. So when I sit with people, I absolutely say that you have to promise me that when, you know, when you get through this work, you're going to go out and help others. And I have sponsees that if they don't have someone they're working with, every time they talk to me or call me for a 10-step, I'm like, who are you working with? Go to a meeting tonight. Look for that new guy with the lights that look clearer than the headlights and chase them, because they run to their car after the meeting. Chase them and tackle them and talk to them and call them the next day. Take their number and call them the next day. Don't wait for them to call you. Pound them a little bit. Call them the next day. And then the next day, people, you'd be amazed how many people I hear like, oh, my God, I can't believe. Years later, they'll come to me and say, I remember you called me the next day. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe you even remembered me. Because people who come in who are new, or even if they've been coming around for a while, still feel like outsiders. And, you know, our deal is to make everybody feel comfortable and bring them in and say, come, you know, do these steps. You know, get the experience that we have. Find the freedom. You know, that third step prayer, freedom from the bondage of self. Man, I have always wanted that, and I never thought I could attain that. You know, and that being comfortable in your skin stuff. And now I don't give a crap what anybody thinks of me anymore. I really don't care. I got to do what I do and say what I say. I am so fallible and imperfect, it's unbelievable. I can tell you that just, and it, you know, for a while when I would listen to speakers, my favorite speakers were always the one that told me, yeah, you know, they tell this great story and then they say, yeah, but, you know, just a month ago I did this. And, you know, because it's not like I'm fixed and everything is great. This is like a forever deal. I mean, I'm going to be doing 10-step work for the rest of my life because I'm sick and twisted on the inside. And my ego always wants to come back and tell me how to stay sick. And so what the hell was I saying? A couple weeks ago, jammed up. My daughter, you know, DUI, in jail, out of jail, all kinds of shit, and I'm not doing good with it, and I don't know, all kinds of crap's going on. You know how it goes, and I'm at the point I can't take it. And I'm crying a bunch of times. And one morning I get up to go to work. It's a Monday morning, and I'm crying. I leave the house, and I start crying. I thought I was okay, and I just start thinking about my daughter and some other things, and I just start crying. I start thinking about sponsees that aren't doing what I want them to do and, you know, that kind of thing. Because the ego's telling me, you know, I need results. And if I'm not getting results from some sponsees, they're out drinking or whatever, somewhere inside the ego says, see, you're not good enough. You know how that goes. See, you're not good enough. That's like my ego's favorite words. You're not good enough. And so I start crying. And I pull over. And my husband's busy working, I know. So I call a friend and talk with him for a while. And I ended up not going to work. Over the weekend, I had been at the shower where there was alcohol. And I had thought I could drink the iced tea that's spiked. And nobody would know. I don't even know. And I thought, really? That's a hideous thought. I didn't do it. But then that Monday, I guess I couldn't take it. I broke down anyways, made the phone call, and I really didn't know what to do with myself. I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to go in the psych ward. I didn't want to go to work. I felt like I couldn't live in myself. And I went away to a hotel. Next town. Just checked into a hotel. Just stayed there all night, and I stayed another night then too because I was liking it so much. So I just had to get away, and it wasn't even my idea. It was other people's idea. I would have said, just brush it off, get it together, go to work. Once you start working, everything will be fine. You'll forget about your problems. Well, I do that a lot, and sometimes I just can't do that, and I couldn't do that a couple weeks ago. So shit happens all the time, and the only thing that keeps me going all the time is that I absolutely know that I cannot run this show. I am lousy at running my life. I've got to let God run my life. And the only way I can stay in touch with God running my life is through prayer and meditation and connection with God and connection with others. Because of my own mind, I can even make up some things that I might think God is saying or doing. So I've got to be connected with others so they can keep me sane and I can know where I'm at. But my relationship with God today is like this open, amazing. I absolutely believe no matter what happens in my life, it's absolutely supposed to happen. The good, the bad, and the ugly. And I know today that if I'm in a space like that Monday morning, and as bad as I was feeling, I absolutely know that it's all going to be okay. That this is part of the plan. And I've got to go through this pain to learn something so I can go out and help somebody else. Because what does it say? No, you know, the further down the scale we've gone, the more that we can help others. So, you know, that experience I had with what I went through somewhere is going to help somebody else. And my time is almost up. And the one thing I would say is maybe tonight I might be reaching out to some of you people who have been coming around here, been coming around the rooms for years and have not really walked the steps. Half-assed maybe a little bit and not really walked them. You know, we have this pride thing. Apparently I did for almost 2 years before actually asking someone to walk through these steps when I was even part of this home group. And so, you know, I just want to remind new people, old people, whoever you are people, you know, that you can walk the steps at any time. And I, for 9 years, I did not find the freedom that I found in following the outline of the steps from the big book and getting connected to a God that I never even could have imagined. In my wildest dreams, I couldn't have fathomed that I would believe that that God did a better job than me running my life. And I absolutely know that today, that I've got to step aside all the time because I'm telling you, I love to run the show and I can't do crap. And I continually remember that God's got this and I don't. So no matter what I go through, it's all in the plan and I just got to keep walking. I tell my sponsees, you know, if you just sit there, God can't do nothing. Start moving. Once you start moving, he'll say, okay, go this way or go that way. But if you sit on your butt and do nothing, he's up there like, okay, or he's wherever. Okay, once you move, I can get you going, but you got to get up yourself. So, you know, if I start walking, I'm going to be guided. If I sit in my own ship for too long, I'm not going to be able to get out. So I got to move for God to guide me and tell me where I'm going. So I think that's it. Thank you.